Another player who likely regained belief in himself, if he ever lost it, is Yankees slugger Alex Rodriguez. Until this year, he struggled in the postseason. Now he goes into his first World Series after a stellar performance in the playoffs. Commentator Frank DeForge says Alex Rodriguez is a player who defies easy definitions.
Someone once asked Fred Zinnemann, the director, what a certain famous movie star was like. What makes you think, Zinnemann replied, that she's like anything? In the same way, the more we learned about Alex Rodriguez, the more I've always asked myself, is he like anything ever? Certainly, there's never been anyone quite like him in sports, the best at his game, the world at his feet, but yet also incorporated within such majesty, insecurity, jealousy, and untrustworthiness. He could be so gauche he could make you cringe. Remember the magazine photograph of A-Rod kissing himself in the mirror? Good grief, even Narcissus was content merely to stare at his own reflection. The worst of him was on display in this last springtime, which he himself refers to now as his rock bottom. A book grossly detailing his flaws and deceit was published, most prominently with the withering accusations of his employment of performance-enhancing drug injections. Somehow that Rodriguez felt it necessary to juice up when he was already the lord of the realm at the peak of his game was all the more incriminating. His public mea culpa was strained and disingenuous, only adding to his unpopularity. But fortune comes in odd disguise. Shortly thereafter, Rodriguez found that he needed hip surgery, and he was yanked off the stage. When he returned, it appeared that his ego had been operated on as well. As he struggled to regain his physical gifts, the man who had always had to be the center of attention appeared not only vulnerable but satisfied to accept his role in an ensemble, even to defer to the young and articulate new Yankee star, Mark Teixeira. A-Rod stopped bloviating, especially about subjects that were beyond everything but his vanity. In the past, he would have grandly exploited his romance with a Hollywood actress. Now his canoodling with Kate Hudson was as veiled as these things can be in the paparazzi world. After a while, nobody even cared. And perhaps more telling, it didn't seem that Rodriguez minded that nobody cared. And then, of course, October, A-Rod's month that had lived in infamy. Had any great player's name in any sport ever so mercilessly been paired with the word choke in a succession of off-seasons? But in his third at-bat in this October's first postseason game, he drove in a run and drove away the boos, and he was off on a tear all the way to the World Series. By the end Sunday night, when New York finished off the Angels, it was A-Rod who the Yankees surrounded. It was hard to believe he was the same person who started the season. He was a teammate. Why, no one even talks about his drug-scarred record anymore. And now, should A-Rod keep it up and lead the Yankees to the championship, what makes you think he's like anything?
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday for member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inske.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Even though the healthcare debate is partly about getting insurance to people who don't have it, much of the discussion focuses on people who, by and large, are already covered, America's senior citizens. Seniors have power, and they're being courted as lawmakers move toward key votes on bills that would extend health insurance to millions of the uninsured. NPR's Julie Rovner has this report on efforts directed at the over 65 set.
While most seniors love their government-run Medicare coverage, there are some things they'd like to see improved. One of those things is the so-called donut hole. It's a quirk in Medicare's prescription drug benefit, where drug coverage stops, but seniors still have to pay their monthly premiums. At a Capitol Hill news conference last week, AARP's Nancy Lamond said it's a fairly widespread problem.
In 17 states, over 30% of all Medicare recipients are in the donut hole. This is a big issue for us.
So, buried in the health care overhaul bills are provisions to address that problem. And unlike many of the other benefits in the bill, said Florida Democratic Congressman Ron Klein, seniors won't have to wait.
We're making this happen right away, as early as January 1 of next year. And from day one, seniors will still see real relief. The donut hole will start to shrink, and seniors who fall into it will immediately pay less for their medicine.
50% less for brand-name medicines, to be specific. And over the next 10 years, the donut hole will be closed completely. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi noted that's faster than was envisioned when the bills were first considered by House committees last summer.
This is one of the improvements from the original bill to now. The first bill was good. This is much better.
Filling in the Medicare drug benefits donut hole is just one of the sweeteners aimed at seniors. There's also free preventive services, and the Senate Finance Committee bill includes the cost of an annual physical for every Medicare patient. Currently, the program only covers a single physical for first-time enrollees. Bob Blinden of the Harvard School of Public Health says it's no secret why Democrats are so anxious to court senior support for their health effort.
Seniors as a group are a swing vote between the parties, and in elections where the president is not running off-year elections, they tend to turn out at much higher proportions than other age groups. And when it comes to voting, it turns out that health care is incredibly important to their vote, much more so than younger voters.
But at the moment, says Blendon, who specializes in public opinion on health care, most seniors have a more negative view of the health overhaul effort than other age groups. He says that's due in part to an all-out effort by Republicans to play up the fact that a significant portion of the bill would be financed by cutting payments to Medicare. Democrats say those cuts are aimed at waste and unnecessary spending and won't affect benefits. But Republicans like David Dreyer of California say that's not how their constituents see it.
They know and understand that a massive government takeover of health care is not the answer to our problem. In fact, it could exacerbate the problem, especially with the proposed Medicare cuts that will hurt our seniors.
But Blendon says at least part of the problem Democrats have with seniors is that they've simply done a bad sales job.
And all they hear about is that their care currently could deteriorate by very large cuts, and they're not at all seeing the potential benefits that the Congress has tried to provide in this legislation for them.
Which helps explain the stepped-up efforts by Democrats in recent weeks to try to publicize the new benefits for seniors. The question remains, though, whether it's too little, too late. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
We're glad you're following our health care coverage this morning on this public radio station. And as you check news headlines throughout the day at NPR.org, you can also offer your own opinions on health care.
And in the other big health story we're following, government health officials say people should start having an easier time getting the vaccine for the H1N1 virus. More than 22 million doses are available now. There were just 14 million doses on hand last week. The shortage has upset millions of people across the country who were standing in lines to get the vaccine for hours.
Congress is still moving to try to get some help to people who are unemployed. The jobless rate, of course, is still high, and that prompted the House to pass a bill last month extending unemployment benefits. Since then, about 400,000 people have seen their benefits end, as infighting in the Senate has slowed down a similar bill. Last evening, the Senate voted to take up the measure, but some differences still remain, as NPR's Audie Cornish reports.
Partisan bickering stalled this bill for nearly a month. First, many Democrats argue that the House bill aimed just at states with the highest unemployment rates was too narrow. New Hampshire Senator Gene Shaheen was among those Democrats who pushed to broaden the provision.
Unemployment isn't a New England problem or a Montana problem or a southern problem. It's a hardship that hits every community in every state in every part of our country.
So the version moving to the Senate floor would provide an additional 14 weeks of unemployment benefits to all states. Where the jobless rate is more than 8.5%, the extension would run 20 weeks. Lawmakers will pay for the $2.4 billion addition by extending the unemployment tax employers are already paying. But in the last few weeks, Republicans have proposed other amendments to the bill, measures related to immigration or the bank bailout program, or to ban funding to the controversial community group ACORN. Majority Leader Harry Reid claims that this is what really slowed things down.
Republicans decided to make a political statement by demanding completely irrelevant amendments, amendments that have little, if anything, to do with unemployment or even the economy generally. And they decided that the political statement was more important than helping their constituents afford to pay bills.
GOP lawmakers dismissed that argument as a partisan attack.
It's kind of hard to understand their position when they have 60 Democrats. They can vote for cloture. They can do anything they want to do. So I think it's a lot of complaining without much merit.
Texas Republican John Cornyn was among the 13 senators who voted against moving forward with debate on the unemployment extension bill. He says he might not support the final version either if GOP lawmakers are frozen out of the amendment process.
Well, what they want to do is they want to do everything on a partisan basis, and all they want to have a vote on is the unemployment benefits without having votes on first-time buyer tax credit and other things that are important to the economy.
But that first-time homebuyer's tax credit, Cornyn mentioned, is the one GOP pitch that seems to have a fighting chance. That amendment would extend a program giving new homebuyers an $8,000 tax credit if they buy a place by the end of next month. Georgia Republican and former realtor Johnny Isaacson sponsored the measure.
Obviously, you've got a difficult economy that's based in housing, the collapse. The first-time homebuyers worked and began to bring back sales. I think it's important to extend that.
Isaacson wants to stretch the program into 2010 and expand it beyond new homebuyers to buyers across the board and buyers with higher incomes. Senate leaders are considering a more limited version that would run the credit program into the spring home buying season before scaling it down to a $2,000 credit by the end of next year. But while they work out the details, some 7,000 people a day run out of unemployment support, and many lawmakers say with or without the home buyer's credit, this bill must go forward. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.
President Obama's top envoy on climate change today dashed hopes of a climate change deal between China and the U.S. when Mr. Obama visits that country next month. The two countries account for 40% of all greenhouse gas emissions. The envoy, Todd Stern, who's in China, said there are still major areas of disagreement. This comes as the countries look ahead to a global climate change conference in December in Copenhagen. NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Shanghai.
We're pushing them and they're pushing us, Todd Stern said, summing up the mood between Chinese and U.S. climate change negotiators. Stern said there'll be no agreement on climate change during Obama's trip to China next month. The focus will be on clean energy cooperation and aligning Chinese and American positions ahead of Copenhagen. However, Stern admitted that differences still remain, particularly over U.S. demands for China to cut its greenhouse gas emissions.
They absolutely have to cap their emissions in the sense of having them reduce significantly as compared to where their trend line is. China could make a reduction twice as ambitious as the U.S. is doing, and still that would still involve their emissions going up somewhere from where they are now.
But Beijing is resisting U.S. pressure, arguing it's using other measures. It's already announced a goal of improving energy efficiency by 20% in the 5 years to 2010. It's also planting trees over an area the size of California. Zhou Fenqi from Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences spells out China's line that emission caps would damage its development.
We could not limit the amount of food for a child because a child needs to grow. He needs more than the adult. So we cannot use the caps.
This despite the fact that China is now the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, according to the International Energy Agency. But China likes to point out that its cumulative emissions are a quarter of America's. Huang Renwei, also from the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences.
This situation is not made by China. It's 100 years ago. So the developed country should share more responsibility than China. So the U.S. could not make this as excuse. China should do most responsibility than U.S.
That's why China wants the U.S. to make much larger emission cuts than those pledged. Beijing also wants developed countries to contribute a portion of their GDP, between 0.5 to 1%, to developing countries to help adapt to global warming. and it's keen for more technology transfers. But Todd Stern says China is unlikely to get much financial assistance from the U.S.
There are various kinds of technology cooperation and technology efforts that could include China. I would not think that there would be large amounts of financial assistance going to China as compared to other developing countries just because of China's relatively advanced state of development.
Stern defended U.S. progress, saying President Obama had done more to reduce emissions than anyone in U.S. history. He also noted the U.S. has pledged $80 billion towards clean energy. But young Chinese environmentalists like Sarah Pang are disappointed with what they see as a lack of U.S. leadership on the issue.
They are demanding that we meet their demands, but they're not doing it themselves. I think the U.S. should set an example for the rest of the world.
In the meantime, China's moving fast. Its goal is to produce 15% of its energy from renewable sources by 2020. It's already the world's largest producer of solar panels. It will overtake the U.S. as the top manufacturer of wind turbines this year. Todd Stern warns the U.S. must take action.
The competitive danger that we have with China is what will happen if we don't move aggressively into the world of green tech and clean energy, because that's the world of economic development in the 21st century, and the Chinese are starting to move there.
On prospects for a deal in Copenhagen, Stern is hedging his bets. I think there's a deal to be had, he said, but that doesn't mean we're going to get it. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
Baseball had its Black Sox, college basketball has had its point-shaving scandals, even contract bridge had its notorious charges of illegal hand signals at the 1965 Bermuda Bowl. So why should tournament Sudoku be any different? Suspicions of cheating arose at last weekend's Philadelphia Inquirer National Sudoku Championship. Those suspicions surround the third-place winner, Eugene Warshawski, because after competing brilliantly in the qualifying rounds, he appeared to be completely inept in the championship round, raising the question, did he have unseen help when he was succeeding? Well, joining us now is the tournament director, Will Shortz, who's familiar to many of you. He's NPR Weekend Edition's puzzle master and also a crossword editor for the New York Times. Welcome to the program, Will.
Hi, Robert.
And tell us about the difference between the preliminary rounds and the championship round in the tournament. Was there anything different about how one had to compete?
Yes, there were three preliminary rounds Saturday morning. Each round had three puzzles. And the fastest and the first person to finish all those puzzles correctly would qualify for the championship round at the end of the afternoon. And that one is conducted on stage for everyone to watch.
Now, Mr. Warshawski, who won $3,000, I gather, for finishing third, was described as wearing a hooded sweatshirt in all the rounds or only in the qualifying rounds?
Well, it was interesting. He came in the middle of the tournament, so the only one that he actually competed in was the third round. Thomas Snyder, a previous year's champion, was the first person to solve that round. He turned around to see who would follow him, and it was a person he had never met before, never seen before, and who was wearing a hood.
Okay, then to the championship round. Was he wearing a hood once again?
In the championship round, you wear headsets to block out outside sounds. When the round started, he pulled the hood over his head as he was solving.
Let's think conspiratorially for a moment here. If I were competing in a Sudoku tournament and I concealed some device to assist me under a hood, what could I do? How could I possibly cheat at Sudoku?
Well, I'm just speculating here because I don't know what happened here. It would be possible, for example, to, in the preliminary round, photograph the puzzles with a device, send them off somewhere else to a confederate to solve the puzzle by computer, and then give you the answer for you to fill in. The playoff puzzle was available only on stage. The audience didn't have it. So if a playoff contestant had a confederate, there was no way really that for him to get the answer to the person on stage.
Okay, next wrinkle. A man also named Eugene Warshawski, and we've been trying to reach Mr. Warshawski, and we reached another man named Eugene Warshawski in Philadelphia, but evidently not the right one. There was another man with the same name suspected of cheating at a chess tournament in Philadelphia a few years ago. Is it the same person?
I have no way to know.
Well, how are you going to go about trying to resolve the allegations or at least the suspicions of cheating here?
Well, first of all, we're going to look at his paper in round three. Normally, when you solve Sudoku, you make marks to help you solve the puzzle faster. So we'll be looking for those. Second, we'll be looking at film and photos of the event. And third, we'll interview the people who were sitting next to this contestant and anyone who had who was with him during the day.
Is this potentially the loss of innocence for championship Sudoku, Will?
Well, I tell you, I've directed the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament for 32 years. Mm-hmm. This is my third year directing the Sudoku Championship. I've directed many puzzle events over my life, and I'm not aware of any instance of cheating before. So this really took me by surprise.
Well, Will, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thanks, Robert.
It's Will Shortz, who's the crossword puzzle editor of the New York Times and also the puzzle master on NPR's Weekend Edition.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.